Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy, and my guests today are Christopher George and Robert Reyes. Christopher George is the author of Terror on the Chesapeake, The War of 1812 on the Bay, published by White Main in 2001, and a 20-year student of America's forgotten conflict. He is the founding editor of the Journal of the War of 1812 and coordinator of the National War of 1812 Symposium Series held each fall since 1996, usually in Baltimore. Chris is now at work on a biography of British Major General Robert Ross in cooperation with Dr. John McCavitt of Rostrever, Northern Ireland. Robert Ross was the British general who captured Washington, D.C. in August 1814 and was killed during the attack on Baltimore 3 weeks later. It is anticipated that the book will be published by the University of Oklahoma Press in their Campaigns and Commanders series in time for the bicentennial of the events of 1814 in which Ross gained his greatest fame. Chris was born in Liverpool, England in 1948. He lives with his wife Donna near the Johns Hopkins University with two older rescue cats, and by profession, he works as a medical editor in Washington, D.C. He has a B.A. in history from Loyola College Baltimore and an M.L.A. from the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Chris is now a U.S. citizen and admits to divided loyalties on the War of 1812. We can talk about that a little later. Robert Reyes was born in Baltimore in 1956. He's married and he resides in Rivera Beach, Maryland. Father is Tom Reyes, Duncan and Royal Yo-Yo Demonstrator. That's great. In 1932, world champ and U.S. World War II combat merchant marine vet. His mother is from the Shenandoah Valley, related to the Big Meadows clan on the Skyline Drive, a World War II Rosie the Riveter at General Motors here in Baltimore. He's retired after 31 years of civil service as archivist and national program manager for postmarks at USPS headquarters in Washington. Employed as greenhouse assistant at UMBC, attended University of Maryland College Park and the University of Washington, Seattle. 10 years private sector, is with Panasonic, Pan Am, Piedmont Airlines, International Harvester, Safeway Stores, AT&T, and Ma Bell. Founder and currently runs the Baltimore Civil War Museum at the President Street Station. Initiated and testified before Congress in April of 1999 for the Stars Spangled Banner National Historic Trail. And he's a national board member of the National Washington Rochambeau Revolutionary Route National Historic Trail. He worked on Maryland's Civil War trails, waysides, and Underground Railroad, map brochure products with the Maryland State Tourism. Former member of the National Parks Mid-Atlantic Council as Fort McHenry representative for the NPS and Northeast Regional Director. He's also a drummer and percussionist with the Reyes Brothers Band, a classic rock band, and father of National Park Service Ranger at Sagamore Hill National Park in Oyster Bay, New York. He's a grandfather with a 9-month old grandson and an O's fan and Ravens PSL owner. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
First thing, Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I first came here in 1955 when I was 7 years old. Although I became homesick and my parents allowed me to go back to England when I was age 11, and I lived with my grandparents until 1968 and came back here. So I was living in Liverpool during the Beatles years, and Paul McCartney was my granddad's brother's paperboy.
Right.
And Uncle Bill, who was a music hall comedian, used to shout at Paul for jumping over the fence dividing the houses.
Yeah.
I've had a long time interest in the War of 1812. In fact, when I came here to Baltimore and I was in school, I'd known about the bombardment of Fort McHenry, and I felt done upon a little bit by the kids in the class jingoistically picking on me, and it felt a little bit shameful that the Redcoats had bombarded Fort McHenry. But of course, at that time, I didn't really separate the Redcoats of the War of 1812 and the Redcoats of the Revolution. It all seemed to be part of the same thing. And when I worked for Hopkins in the 1990s, I found out that the British had landed an army at North Point, had started to march upon Baltimore, and that the British General Robert Ross was killed in a skirmish preceding the Battle of North Point. I became very fascinated with the story, being a child of two countries, to want to examine the relationship between the British and the Americans, and to explore this little-known war. And so that's what led me to found the Journal of the War of 1812, led me to write for the Maryland Historical Magazine, and ultimately my book that involved me going to Ireland to research where Ross was from, to Scotland and England, as well as researching over here. And it's been a great ride, and it's been wonderful to be able to inform the public about this and tell them about things about the war that they don't know, or the war that they don't know, should I say.
Robert, what about you? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm, born and grew up here in Baltimore. I'm sort of a product of the Port of Baltimore, being that my dad was a merchant marine. He lived throughout the United States and all the major coastal cities on the West Coast, East Coast, and the Gulf, but ended up here in Baltimore. Met my mother sometime after the Second World War. She is from the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, as you in the introductions, and they met post-war and married and raised our family here. So I actually have no relatives in Maryland other than my three brothers and sister, and I was the one in the family that was sort of wired for the interest in history, all history, but primarily American history. Always interested in history as a child, always read and referenced books on history going back from the, you know, the Romans forward. As you know, in school here about the War of 1812, it's not something they teach you. They teach you the American Revolution. They sort of jump over the War of 1812 and the Mexican War, and they jump to the Civil War. And then they sort of jump over the wars, like the Spanish-American War, and go to World War I, World War II, and world affairs. So the War of 1812 is a war you have to basically learn on your own. I remember going to Fort McHenry as a small child, knee-high, and remember the Greek statue there holding the small harp or the lyre. That always kind of fascinated me, but really didn't know too much about the history until, like Chris said later on, something I learned on my own. One of the things that I had learned at a 1992 visit to the annual Defenders Day at Fort Howard was there was a gentleman there who worked for the Baltimore Sun named Pat McGuire, who had a model of miniature soldiers and set up on a diorama board. And I asked him, here's North Point Road, where is the Baltimore Beltway? So he goes, it would be right about here because it runs parallel with North Point Road. So I said, oh, my goodness. So the battlefield is actually on the Baltimore Beltway as part of it. Never realized that before. Soon after that, in October, I wrote a letter to then-Governor Schaefer, William Donald Schaefer, and asked if he would reconsider renaming that section of the Beltway Defenders Memorial Highway that would connect with John F. Kennedy Memorial Highway with a memorial to honor the North Point Defenders. Being, you know, our state holiday, September 12th is Defenders Day. So he actually liked the idea and embraced it. And I worked with the highway officials to get this memorial dedicated in 1996 on Defenders Day. And that was the day I met Christopher George.
Oh, great. I was going to get to that.
So since this Defenders Day of the 1996, when the highway memorial was dedicated, we've been working together, and we've worked on not only initiating the idea for the Star-Spangled Banner National Historic Trail, but also we also worked with Governor Ehrlich on the acquisition of the Mars Supermarket property, which was part of the North Point battlefield, and it has now been acquired by the state of Maryland, and it has become now is the North Point State Battlefield on North Point Road. It's a 9-acre battlefield park. We're currently working on a memorial to dedicate to the American and British soldiers who were killed there, including General Robert Ross, who Chris mentioned earlier.
Well, that's great. When you were saying that, it made me think, too, that all this history here that we don't really know anything about, to really get that going with school kids and see what we can do about that. Do you have anything to do with that right now?
We have spoken before, school groups, and that's something that we especially want to do, to spread the knowledge to the young. Because one of the things that Robert very often points out when we're at a certain event and speaking, say, to a group at a library or a church hall or wherever, they're older people. They're at least our age or older, most of the people there. And we feel a great need to want to reach to the young and tell them the story, things that they should know about the history of their own area.
There's an alarming trend, and I am the founder of the Baltimore Civil War Museum in President Street Station. And as you mentioned in the introduction, I also work on the Washington Rochambeau National Historic Trail, which is the Yorktown campaign of 1781, when we won our independence from the British. Okay, so, and I've attended, you know, I kind of play in three circles of history: Civil War, the War of 1812, and the American Revolution. And as Chris was saying, there's an alarming, disturbing trend that I'm noticing when we're speaking to or at meetings with historical organizations, whether it's a roundtable or a symposium or a lecture. The demographics in the room, if you look around, it's like the baby boomers are like the end of the line. It's like the baby boomers and back. There's no Generation X, the next generation, came out of the baby boomers, they're in numbers. It's sort of an alarming trend. Like, what is going to happen to our institutional memory of our national heritage if, you know, once the baby boomers are gone, if it's not carried on by the next succeeding generation? So
well, that's a very good point, because I think there's baby boomers that don't even know a third of the stuff that you guys talk about and know about the War of 1812 about it. So I think it's across demographics that we need to address, and hopefully I can help with this station.
Great.
Just because it's really interesting stuff. We talk about that on the on the Beltway. I mean, I'm sure there's other places, lots of other places that
sure.
and find historic stuff that's just amazing in Baltimore. Talk a little bit more about Baltimore's role in the War of 1812 and 1814, which is the bicentennial coming up now.
I often say that the War of 1812 is kind of hard to explain. It is a war that's much overshadowed by the American Revolution and the Civil War. Unlike Canada, where it's really the big war of independence, almost from the British, their patriotic war, that they ultimately, of course, won independence from the British, becoming a dominion, a country of their own instead of a British colony. They see it as their great patriotic war. They don't have other wars that overshadow it in the 19th century. But also, the war was pretty much of a stalemate. Most of the war was fought up in Canada. One of the reasons that the British came into the Chesapeake Bay was to try to make the American government bring American troops from up in Canada down to the Chesapeake to defend the nation's capital. But the Secretary of War at the time, John Armstrong, kept sending the best American troops up there and would consistently say that Washington could not possibly be a target. He was saying that up to the last 24 hours before the British captured Washington, D.C. So it was a national tragedy and really quite a major stain on the administration of James Madison that the Secretary of War would allow this to happen. And yet, to my amazement, and I still don't quite understand it, Madison comes out of the war with credit. And part of that is that even in Europe, people deplored the fact that the buildings of Washington were burned by the British. Now, as for Baltimore, as compared to D.C., one of the reasons that the British wanted to attack Baltimore was because of the privateers that operated out of Baltimore that had taken quite a fearsome toll of British shipping. In fact, it became quite an issue with the merchants of Britain and the insurance underwriters, Lloyd's. The millions of pounds that were lost to privateers such as the Chasseurs which is the forerunner of today's Pride of Baltimore, which is based on Captain Thomas Boyle's chasseur that was hailed by Niles Weekly Register when it came into Baltimore Harbor in the spring of 1815 as the Pride of Baltimore, in quote marks, and was saluted by the guns of Fort McHenry.
A lot of people hear the name privateer and are not quite sure, because that's sort of not in our vocabulary today. Yeah. It's kind of a queer name, an odd name. What does privateer mean? Well, privateer is the private navy. Okay. Right. In Great Britain, they call it the Merchant Navy. And here in America, we call it the Merchant Marine, which my dad is retired from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when the War of 1812 started, the revolution had been over for 30 years. We did have six or seven frigates that were commissioned in late 1790s. But basically, our navy was non-existent. I mean, the British had over 600 war vessels. So we were, you know, we're facing the most powerful navy in the world, and they were the most powerful navy in the world up till, I think, we surpassed them in the 20th century.
Yeah.
So we basically were able to use our merchant vessels as our little private navy or privateers, and they would get a letter of marque, which is basically a contract with the government as a contractor to attack British shipping and hurt them in their pocketbook. And as Chris was saying, the Lloyds of London put direct pressure on Parliament and the King because of the losses. You know, the insurance rates were going through the roof. That's one way that the United States could impact. One other thing is one of the privateers of Baltimore here was under the Commodore Joshua Barney. He is a Baltimorean. He not only is a hero of the War of 1812, leading his men to the Battle of Bladensburg, his naval men, but he also was the mastermind of the Mosquito Fleet, which protected the Chesapeake Bay. It was that we didn't have a Coast Guard in the days of the War of 1812, and he went to the Secretary of the Navy with this idea of this small gunboat fleet. They were row barges, 100 feet long. They had sail, but they also had oarsmen, and they would have a gun mounted on the bow to attack British shipping. It's almost like later on during the Second World War, where we had PT boats, torpedo boats. They could go out and attack capital ships and then run up into the shallows, into the rivers, and the capital
couldn't follow them.
You know, you can kind of think of these row barges that Joshua Barney basically envisioned, and some were built here in Baltimore, were sent out on the Chesapeake Bay to attack the invader, the British Navy, in which many claim the Chesapeake Bay was a British lake. But Barney was a hero of the American Revolution. People can read about him. And because he was a hero in the War of 1812, he received swords for his valor at the Battle of Bladensburg. Basically, a lot of people feel that, you know, we've heard of John Paul Jones because he is the one buried at the Naval Academy. But John Paul Jones wasn't in the War of 1812. He was only in the American Revolution. Where Barney was a hero in both. And a lot of people feel that he should be the one that's sort of held up during this bicentennial. You know, the one that we look to here in Maryland is one of the great heroic figures.
Well, let's pursue that. Still some time,
well,
isn't it?
Well, I think that, he is kind of the neglected figure in all this, that he was the one guy who led the most resistance at Bladensburg. This is a battle that it was fought August 24th, 1814. It's often laughably called the Bladensburg Races, because it's true that the militia mostly fled. But if they'd been better led by Brigadier General William H. Winder, who was a political appointee, U.S. Army, but he was the nephew of the governor of Maryland, Levin Winder. And politics then works pretty much like politics today. And he was appointed in order to hopefully get Maryland to release troops for the defense of Washington, D.C. He'd been captured in his only previous battle, main battle, up in Canada at Stony Creek, June 6, 1813, and recently exchanged. and named the commander of the 10th Military District that included Baltimore and Washington. Only on July the 4th, 1814, barely 6 weeks before the British landed at Benedict on the Patuxent and started marching towards Washington, D.C. He was a lawyer in peacetime and, as I say, better at shuffling paper than putting men in battle. And he made a fatal mistake at Bladensburg because he should have had all the American troops at the bridge over what is now the Anacostia River. It was then called the Eastern Branch of the Potomac River. If he'd have had all his troops there, the British perhaps would not have got across the bridge. It was a 100 degrees day. Some of the British actually died by the side of the road marching to Bladensburg. And Hanson Catlett, who was a U.S. Army surgeon, said that they were all out of shape after being on board ship for a couple of months coming from Europe. They should have been defeated rather than won the battle. The second American line, some people call it the third line, I call it the second line, was commanded by Commodore Barney, which was up the Washington Road, what is now Fort Lincoln Cemetery. If Winder had told the first troops to fall back to the second troops and fought the British there, the battle might have had a different result as well. But he told the first line to retreat up the Georgetown Road instead of the Washington Road. So these guys were completely off the battlefield and in total disorder. And so the British were, in effect, able to win two battles in one day. Commodore Barney was severely wounded with a musket ball in the thigh. He was immediately recognized by Ross and Coburn as being the man who'd given them the most trouble, both on the Patuxent and at Bladensburg. And they valued and honored him for his courage. And so they immediately paroled him and sent him to recuperate at a tavern in Bladensburg.
Isn't it amazing the more things change, the more they stay the same? Right. Business initiatives pushing the war, and also political appointees,
right.
Military,
Well, another thing, stuff. Like 9/11, they had to have a big government inquiry after the loss of Washington. And who should chair the inquiry but War of 1812 hero from the West, from Kentucky, Colonel Richard M. Johnson, who was a congressman. He would later on become vice president. And he was the guy who allegedly shot Tecumseh at the Battle of the Thames in October 1813. There's a lot of controversy about whether he actually did that, but there are paintings and engravings and statues that show him doing it. But other people, just much like the shooting of General Ross, there are a number of claims, counterclaims to Johnson having done the deed.
I wanted to mention that 9/11, we're sort of infamous day in history in our lifetime, but on 9/11, 1814, the church bells here in Baltimore rang out. The British had been sighted in the bay, standing up the bay. So the church bells, all the church bells in the city of Baltimore rang at 11 o'clock, calling out the militia.
Right, because when you said 9/11, 1814,
right.
Okay.
So the militia was called out, and they began their march down the Philadelphia Road to North Point Road, where they were deployed to check the British's advance. And as Chris was saying, in the early skirmish, which opened the Battle of North Point, General Ross, when the shooting started, he was a leader by example. He rode up to the front to reconnoiter what was going on. And, American sharpshooters and riflemen, for that matter, we're not quite sure if he was shot by a rifleman or someone from the 5th Maryland Regiment. Mm. But, they were taught to shoot men on horses. They were taught to shoot officers. That goes back to the Revolution.
Sure.
So, once you pluck an officer off, as even the British said in the aftermath, that was like losing, hundreds or thousand men to lose that general. Because, they were basically cutting the head off. So one of the other things I wanted to point out, Commodore Barney's second in command was a name that is not on anybody's lips today, but he happened to turn out to be the hero of the Battle of Baltimore. His name is Sailing Master Lieutenant John Adams Webster of Harford County, Maryland. He was at the Battle of Bladensburg. He was an eyewitness to Commodore Barney being wounded, and then he marched with the flotillamen. These were the guys, the oarsmen, as I mentioned, in the row barges of Barney's Chesapeake Bay Flotilla. They marched to Baltimore following the Battle of Washington. He was deployed over in the Middle Branch near the Hanover Strait Bridge, right where the Baltimore Sun plant is today, Fort Covington. So there was a Fort Covington there, and there was a Fort Babcock there. So the British, of course, we know that was a two-prong attack. Everyone knows about Francis Scott Key, you know, and all the heroic figures, Commodore Rodgers, Rodgers Bastion at Patterson Park, and of course, General Smith, the commander of the department here in Baltimore, the military department, taking command of the military department here. But no one talks about John Adams Webster. The gentleman was basically at Fort Babcock in the Middle Branch near the Hanover Strait Bridge. The British failed in their attack on Fort McHenry. Fort McHenry was the key to the battle. Baltimore could not be taken unless the British could basically pound the fort in submission and then go through that narrow blocked channel that the Americans had blocked with sunken ship hulks and a big, gigantic chain across the Northwest Branch, which leads into the Inner Harbor and the Canton waterfront. So in order to do that, they had to pound the fort into submission. Well, the fort is a masonry fort. And the Americans basically got behind the masonry walls on the opposite side, on the city side, to basically repulse this this attack. So then the British tried to, okay, we're going to try to take some Marines and land in the rear, in the Middle Branch, over by the Hanover Strait Bridge, and try to attack the fort from the rear. And this is where John Adams Webster was stationed, at Fort Babcock. So in the middle of the night, he happened to be catching a little shut-eye up on the entrenchment of the fort. They were dug in. So he was basically catching a little shot up on top of the earthwork when he thought he heard the sound of muffled oars. So he took his telescope out, and he looked out onto the black, dark night of the water, and he saw a little glimmer of here and there, a little flicker. He basically sound battle stations. And his battery Babcock, opened up on these British barges. There were 20 of them. And I believe there was as many as 1,000 Royal Marines in these barges that were going to land over there. So when he opened up, it set the alarm off for the other Port Covington open up. Mm. And the Circle Battery, which is Riverside Park, to open up. And of course, Fort McHenry opened up. This night attack was repulsed in the Middle Branch. Now, in the aftermath of the Battle of Baltimore, you look at, well, who was honored? Was it Francis Scott Key, who wrote the famous poem? Was it General Smith, who was the commanding general who set these defenses up in Baltimore? Was it Commodore Rodgers at Hampstead Hill? No. If you look at the aftermath, the city of Baltimore honored John Adams Webster with a presentation sword as a gift. The only other person it received an award, Major Armistead, for his valor at Fort McHenry. He received a punch bowl. And then, later on, John Adams Webster received another presentation sword from the state of Maryland, from the people of the state of Maryland. No one else. So, in their minds, the people on the ground in 1814, they must have thought and knew this was the key moment. This was the moment of you know, when the British actually could have broke through.
And this is a game changer.
Exactly. And critical mass.
I guess that's
the word I'm looking for.
The modern term.
This was the moment of critical mass that John Adams Webster was able to repulse this rear attack. The British was under the command of Lieutenant Napier, Charles Napier. He was a very capable British commander. And what would have happened was, if the British would have landed, if Webster did not wake up and sound battle stations, they would have landed in the rear of Fort McHenry and taken the fort from the rear. What would have happened next is the British Navy would have been able to move up, because even though they had sunken hulks across the Northwest Passage at Fort McHenry, all the way across Lazaretto, it still had an opening for one ship to go through at a time. So they would have just brought their Navy up, brought them through one ship at a time, and then they would have bombarded those earthworks at Hampstead Hill for 25 hours. And basically, you know, in World War I, you know, people get shocked. They go into shock when they're bombed in trenches. You know,
shell shock.
So that's what happened. And then the British were they brought their army up Philadelphia Road, Pulaski Highway today, and they were going to attack the fort in Echelon. They would have had the Navy supporting the Army's attack on Hampstead Hill, the works that basically were set up there. The key to the Battle of Baltimore is the Fort McHenry. It had to be taken. They couldn't take it from the front, and they were repulsed from taking it from the rear. And no one today talks about this hero, Sailing Master John Adams Webster, one of Joshua Barney's men, his second in command here at the Battle of Baltimore.
The dates that you mention, you're talking about next year from June through September.
Right.
I think what we could do is to compile an event calendar or database,
sure.
And then we can work on making events for those specific dates.
Yes.
Because it is fascinating. But what we learn in school is just real basic things. Colonel so-and-so went up and took this hill.
Let's talk about the events to date. I mean, there is a state commission that the governor set up, the War of 1812 Commission.
Right.
Chris and I are members of it for the
interpretive. Right, I was going to ask you about that because there's a War committee. Of 1812.
And basically, they have a website. It's called Star Spangled Banner 200. So right. Anyone can go on there and find the events that are associated with coming up through next year. There will be a celebration again, I believe, in September. The Blue Angels will be coming back. They were here last June.
Right. Celebration.
That's right.
Celebration, S-A-I-L. Maryland, you know, they've been planning this for years because Maryland knows that the Chesapeake campaign became famously known for basically has this story, this history all to itself. So Maryland State Tourism years ago, Chris and I worked on some of the brochure products that were distributed before even the Star-Spangled Banner National Historic Trail was signed into law. The state of Maryland was already on the ball, basically.
Well, we actively lobbied Maryland Tourism back in the 1990s and told them what a great story this was. I would hazard to say that Star-Spangled Banner National Historic Trail, what Maryland is doing, would not have happened, maybe.
Yeah, we originally envisioned this. I'm familiar with the National Historic Trail system because I've traveled near and far, and I've been on the Lewis and Clark Trail and the Oregon Trail. Mm-hmm. So I was familiar with National Historic Trails were. They're basically a program that's administered by the National Park Service. So I had envisioned this Defenders National Historic Trail. Remember, that's what our heroes are called here. Our state holiday, September 12th, is Defenders Day. Fortunately, Mr. George here was at a historian conference in the late 90s in Tennessee and
Kentucky. I was in Lexington.
There was the historian from Antietam National Battlefield, Ted Alexander, was attending that and spoke to Mr. George that, no, you should not call it Defenders National Historic Trail. You should call it the Star-Spangled Banner National Historic Trail. So he bought that tidbit back, and then I expressed it to Senator Paul Sarbanes' office, who we were working with, and at first his right-hand man, Charlie Steck, said, oh, well, we're not sure what we're going to call it yet. We may call it the War of 1812. We're not sure. I said, Charlie, think about it. Star-Spangled Banner, National Historic Trail. I mean, everyone knows that's the one thing of this war people remember.
In this
our
world.
National anthem. Yeah. So I think they gave it some thought, and basically they had a consensus that, yeah, so that became the official name and working title. Congress, which you mentioned in the introduction, we testified earlier in April of 99 for this trail. The original sponsors was Senator Paul Sarbanes and Congressman Wayne Gilchrist. I testified for Congressman Gilchrist before a House subcommittee on natural resources. Ralph Eshelman, War of 1812 historian, testified for Senator Paul Sarbanes. It went through several Congresses before it actually was passed. So it was passed in 2008 under Senator Ben Cardin and Congressman John Sarbanes. So that's when it was signed into law by President Bush. in May of 2008. You know, since then, it's sort of taken on a life of its own. The National Trail is under the Chesapeake Bay Gateway's office in Annapolis. The National Park Service has an office there, which oversees Chesapeake Bay Gateways and other programs they administer. Also, the John Smith Chesapeake Bay National Historic Trail is also administered out of that office.
Chris, you have had a few events recently. Can you talk about them?
Are you talking about different things that I've either arranged or...
things that I've missed.
Yeah, I've talked all around Maryland. In fact, I was out in Garrett County at the end of May, and they had a War of 1812 weekend. And it was kind of amazing that a lot of people, reenactors, came to it, a lot of them from various places in the Chesapeake. And I gave two talks, one a general talk on the War of 1812 in the Chesapeake, and one specifically on the African-Americans of the war, and that's one of my specific interests. We believe that about 3,000 to 5,000 former slaves were transported out by the British. They were offered freedom actively by the British in 1813 and 1814, and specifically by Admiral Cochrane, April 2nd, 1814, issued a proclamation that was helpfully printed by the American press saying that they could have land in British possessions given their freedom. And so many hundreds of slaves fled to the British, were mostly transported out to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where their descendants live today. About 200 able-bodied male former slaves fought as colonial marines, and their descendants today live in Trinidad in five company towns. This is a small book put out by John McNish Weiss, a London researcher. He's actually married to a lady who's descended from a colonial marine. They were given land in five company towns in Trinidad, and they call themselves the Americans, which is the name of the book. The Americans, no A, Free Black American Settlers in Trinidad, 1815 to 1816. And what amazes me is that even though they were slaves when they were here in the United States, they still see themselves as being Americans as compared to other people in Trinidad who are descendants of French or Spanish ethnicities and so on. Also, Gene Smith was part of our symposium at the Marines Detachment on Fort Avenue. Supposed to be at Fort McHenry, but because of the government shutdown, we met on October the 5th at the Marines Detachment. He spoke about the slaves' gamble choosing sides in the War of 1812, and it's a book that I would highly recommend. We hope to hold our next symposium, the 18th National War of 1812 Symposium, at Fort McHenry in October 2014, and it will be a big one.
I want to mention the African-American experience here in the United States forces. Going back again to the privateering again with the private Navy, one of the things that these merchant vessels were able to do, any prizes of war they captured, they had to legally bring them in, and then they had the cargo was basically inventoried and then divided, and they got a cut, a share of the prize. It was said that one privateering expedition, it sets you up for life. That's how great the take was at times. So because of that, a lot of people were in the private Navy instead of the U.S. Navy. And because of that, the U.S. Navy was always open to having African-Americans serve as seamen. This year is the anniversary, the bicentennial, last month, of the Battle of Lake Erie with Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry. And there's a book written about his exploits and his great naval victory in Lake Erie. And the book is Amongst My Best Men by Gerald Althoff. And he's talking about his African-American seamen that, you know, crewed his ships like the Lawrence and the Niagara on Lake Erie. You know, last month also the Postal Service, which I'm retired from, issued a stamp for the Battle of Lake Erie which the famous painting of Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry transferring his flag. The Lawrence had been sunk, so he had to transfer his flagship to the close by USS Niagara, and that's the famous painting that's in the the halls of the U.S. Capitol. Of him transferring, he's like on a rowboat, you know, transferring his flag. It's probably the most famous painting or art image in history of a commander transferring his flag to another ship. So that's the actual image that's on, as part of the postage stamp. But anyway, this is the bicentennial of 1813 this year, and that's what is being settled. Chris could also tell you about a gentleman named Charles Ball, who I believe, and a William Williams, who were, I believe, escaped slaves. Changed their name and identity, and also served in the American forces here in the Battle of Baltimore.
Talking about sailors, we believe about one in every five U.S. Navy sailors and one in every five aboard merchant ships were African Americans. And one reason that we know all that is because British prison depot records are so good. They record which ship these guys were captured from, how old they were, what they looked like, whether they were a white man or a black man, their height and so on. There was one black man called Richard Crafus or Richard Seavers, who was 6'4" tall. And from it says in the records that he was from Vienna. We believe that it's Vienna, Maryland, and that he was much taller than most men of the time, which were, the records show, about 5'6" or so. So he was about a foot taller, and he was in the cell block 4 at Dartmoor Prison, and he taught boxing and was kind of the commander of the prison block. He later on became a leader of the black community in Boston. So he was one of a number of men. Another Marylander was a man named George Roberts, who was a man from Canton, captured early in the war when he was on board the Sarah Anne, captained by Captain Richard Moon. He was later on a gunner aboard the Chasseur, which, as I said earlier, was the pride of Baltimore.
That's half a dozen shows in itself, really. Like, my gosh. I mean, I hate to be so inarticulate and keep saying, wow, wow, but wow. And this is just an introductory show because I really want to pursue what we've been talking about. Because, like I say, it's just fascinating that different parts of Baltimore, you said Vienna was on the Eastern Shore. I mean, all over. Anything you want to add on the 1812? And then I want to ask you a little bit about the Civil War Museum.
One of the things, Chris's symposium that was just held here a couple weeks ago at the Marine Memorial on Fort Avenue, there was some good discussion going on about the impressment of sailors, the war hawks, the Democrats, James Madison Party. The discussion today is the War of 1812 was a direct result of British boarding free American vessels during the Napoleonic War and seizing crews who they thought were British subjects hiding on these American ships. But this practice had been going on for years before that. One was the French Quasi-War during John Adams' administration, just kind of spreading up to the end of his administration. That caused an undeclared war. The French Quasi-War, we were at war with France in an undeclared war because they were impressing our sailors, stopping our ships. My question is, why wasn't the War of 1812 an undeclared war? Well, there was another motive behind the War Hawks. They had been pushing Indians. You know, basically, you've heard of the term manifest destiny.
Sure.
Okay. So once the 13 colonies and states were established after the Revolution, they were looking west, and the next place was the Ohio Valley. But the problem was the British were there with their forts.
That's a bit of a problem.
Okay. And then on the other side of them was the French. Okay, so we had to get the British out of there to expand west. The discussion is now one of the direct emphasis or impulses of the war, impetus, if that's the word, to strike a blow against Britain. One thing, they were busy fighting Napoleon over there, so they were weak, they were preoccupied, they couldn't, you know, we thought maybe we could seize land in the west, chase those British out of those forts in the west, take the Ohio Valley, and then move on to the Mississippi River. And one of the things I asked one of the historians that did have a lecture on the movement of the Indian tribes, you know, it goes up through Andrew Jackson and on beyond the Civil War, the Napoleonic War, Napoleon needed money for the French army to fight all these different countries in Europe. You know, he's fighting everybody. France is fighting everybody. So he went to Jefferson and said, hey, I'll sell you our territory, the Louisiana Purchase, which we all know became, you know, which opened up the Lewis and Clark expedition later, okay? You know, my question was, as a historian, had not that have happened, if not Napoleon sold the Louisiana Purchase, would we have been fighting the French next for that land? See, they basically gave it to us, or we bought it fairly cheap. But had they not, and they had their forts out there after the War of 1812, and once we got to the Mississippi, I think we would have been fighting the French. I mean, that was kind of removed because Napoleon needed the money. He did sell the Louisiana Purchase, you know.
But that's fascinating in itself, that just these little instances, like you talk about going down the wrong road, change the course of history. You don't hear about that when you're taking history at school.
You know, the War of 1812 and indeed the Louisiana Purchase are both kind of outcomes of the war in Europe. Napoleon was strapped for money, so he had to sell the Louisiana Purchase to the United States. The War of 1812 probably would not have happened except for the war in Europe, and the British needed those men for the crews of their big 74-gun and bigger ships. Desertion was a big problem, and so they were constantly trying to raid the ships of other countries in order to get men to be crew members aboard their own warship. What interests me more than maybe the war actions that happened is the national symbols that came out of the war. The Star Spangled Banner, Don't Give Up the Ship, Old Ironsides, Andrew Jackson, New Orleans. Even Uncle Sam was a provisions merchant in Troy, New York, so he comes out of the war too. So it's those national symbols and the personal stories. People like the black man Charles Ball, who was on board Commodore Barney's flotilla, George Roberts, the seaman, etc. Stories of Armistead. You know, there's a lot about the Star Spangled Banner. A lot of people think that the big flag flew over the fort during the battle. Did it? No, it didn't, because there was a big storm going on, so they would have had the smaller storm flag flying during the battle. The pieces that are missing from the flag are mostly because the Armistead family, for years afterward, gave little pieces of the flag to visitors. Major Armistead died only a couple of years after the war, but his family, when they received visitors for years later, gave away pieces. There's a star missing, which may have been given to the Marquis de Lafayette when he came to Baltimore in 1824. And did Francis Scott Key actually see the flag? I have my doubts, because he was quite some distance down the river. He'd written an earlier song, and mind you, it was a song and not a poem, and that's what David Hildebrand, who's a period music expert, says. And it's true that it was going to be set to this music, to Anacreon in Heaven, very often said to have been a British drinking song, but actually it was a gentleman's club song named after a Greek god. He'd written an earlier song 10 years earlier at the time of the Tripoli War, also talking about the Stars and Stripes, and set to the same music. So we already knew what he was going to set the words to. As Scott Sheeds, the Ranger historian at Fort McHenry, told me years ago, although he seems to have changed his tune a little bit recently, the bombs gave proof that our flag was still there. So in other words, because he knew that the bombardment was still going on, the flag must be still flying.
We could talk for hours and days and weeks, but this is just an introductory, and we're going to do some more. I wanted to hear just a little bit about the Civil War Museum that you run there, Robert, and then you guys give some contact infos, and then
okay.
You know, go on.
Basically, I lived in Seattle, Washington for a couple of years, and when I came back to Baltimore after my wife had gotten pregnant, I was kind of forced to come back home and start over. When I got back here, I thought that if there's anything I could ever do for history, I'd like to get involved as a volunteer or something. So some years went by. We came back in 79 and in 89. I started thinking about, boy, it'd be nice if Baltimore had a Civil War museum. So the first place I thought that one could exist here would be on Federal Hill, where there was a occupation fort that was built to basically hold Baltimore and Maryland in the Union. What led to that was I had talked to it was the Baltimore Civil War Roundtable. I got in touch with them. That's basically a study group, studies, and they have lectures on the Civil War. And this is a monthly meeting that this organization has. And they said there's a group trying to get a Civil War museum at the President Street Station. And I said, well, I know about Camden Station, and I know about Mount Clair. Where is President Street Station? I never had no idea there was a railroad station on the east side of the Inner Harbor. Rode by it a million times on the way to Fells Point when we used to go bar hopping, whatever. But it used to be very dark down the end of President Street at Fleet. There was warehouses there. Little Italy was on the edge there, but it was just a dark, dank.
Way before Harbor East, yeah.
Exactly. Way before that. And you would ride by President Street Station all the time and just not know it was there. Maybe you thought it was warehouses. That was a building that has survived since 1849. It is the oldest big city railroad station in the United States. The only railroad station actually older is the one in Ellicott City, the B&O railroad station in Ellicott City. But President Street Station, circa 1849, is where a number of events basically intersect with history, starting as the first major sea rail link in the United States, 1831, where the railroad meets the port of Baltimore. This is before New York has a railroad to their port, and before Philadelphia. Baltimore has one first. The railroad station was the site of where today the line begins at President and Fleet Street and goes on out Boston and connects with today's Amtrak line. The Amtrak line today between Baltimore and Philadelphia was built by this railroad, the Philadelphia-Wilmington-Baltimore Railroad. This organization, the Friends of the President Street Station, was looking to put a Civil War museum. Why a Civil War museum at the President Street Station? Well, a couple of things happened in its history to kind of make a logical sense that it should be there. Number one, President Abraham Lincoln, as we all know, won the election in November of 1860. He only received about 3,000 votes in the state of Maryland, statewide. You know, Baltimore and Maryland is a Democratic city and state as it was during the Civil War. And Lincoln, this Republican candidate, did not get any support. Now, there were people that did support Lincoln here in Baltimore and Maryland, but just not many. There was a plot uncovered as he was traveling from his home in Springfield to Washington as president-elect to assassinate him when he arrived here in Baltimore. So actually, he was snuck through Baltimore in the middle of the night through the President Street Station. So that is called the Baltimore Plot. That's number one. Following that, Fort Sumter was attacked. We all know our Civil War history. That's April 12th, 1861. Lincoln calls as his first war proclamation for 75,000 volunteers to come to defend the Capitol. That is on April 15th. His second presidential proclamation, which was an act of war, was he said he was going to put the Anaconda Plan, which was a plan that was basically conceived by aging General Winfield Scott of War of 1812 fame. He was still the commanding general when the Civil War started. He was too fat to mount a horse, so he was basically an armchair general. He was the main consultant for the U.S. Army. He had basically envisioned the Anaconda Plan, which was to blockade all the southern ports. That is a federal act of war, to say that and to basically do that. Well, that went into effect on April 19th, 1861. On the same day, Lincoln's first trainload of volunteers was arriving from the Northeast, the 6th Massachusetts Regiment, fully armed and uniformed, and the Pennsylvania Regiment, the Washington Brigade from Philadelphia. They were in a train behind them. They arrived here on the morning, about 10 o'clock in the morning on April 19th. And as they began to cross the city, if you ever remember the political gangs that was in the movie The Gangs of New York, there were political gangs here in Baltimore like that. They were called Plug Uglies and Blood Tubs. A lot of them were off-duty firemen, and they would have kids sit on fire plugs. That's where that Plug Uglies come from, to guard the water before the other, because back then the fire departments were private. They were not municipal. and they would actually fight over who was going to put the fire out. So, and when they weren't fighting fires, a lot of them sometimes were involved in these political gangs, these blood tubs, these plug uglies, and they would terrorize the populace toward election time, make people vote. You know, they had something called cooping, where they would kidnap people, beat them up, and make them go in and vote, and then dump them. These were the instigators of this Civil War riot that occurred on the morning of April 19th. What they did was when the railroad cars came into Baltimore at the President Street Station, they unhooked the locomotive and the tender, the car was wood and coal, and they had draft horses like Clydesdales pull each individual railroad coach across the city to Camden Station, Camden Yards, and vice versa. Locomotives were not allowed on Pratt Street in Inner Harbor. It was a very tight straight grid. It was very crowded with wagons and horses and people, just as much as it is today with cars and people and automobiles. It was crowded back then. So Philadelphia had the same arrangement. Chicago did not have an arrangement like this. Chicago used to allow trains to run down the street in the middle of the day, and they would run people over. They would run trainloads of hogs into the lakefront. So it was very dangerous. You've heard of the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Oh, yeah.
These are people dodging trolley cars. So people would dodge railroads cars as well, like in the Windy City, because these trains would just chug down the street. Well, in Baltimore and Philadelphia, they didn't allow that. They had to have draft horses tow these railroad cars. So this political mob dumped anchors from the harbor on the track, blocking the basic passage of these railroad cars. So now the Massachusetts soldiers that arrived at President Street Station, remainder, had to detrain and march on foot. So as they made their way across the Inner Harbor on Pratt Street, they were surrounded by this huge mob. And that's when the stones and the missiles and sticks and clubs began to fly. And then there was gunfire. So the soldiers returned gunfire. This caused the first casualties of the Civil War. No one was killed at Fort Sumter a week before. Basically, it was a fireworks show. So the first federal volunteers were killed in Baltimore, and the first civilians attacking them were killed. 12 civilians, 4 soldiers. Now, the police came down, was the next thing that happened, and escorted the bulk of the troops back where the aquarium is today, Gay and Pratt, up to Camden Station. Well, the mob knew there were more volunteers coming to Baltimore. These were Massachusetts soldiers and Pennsylvania soldiers, but they knew there were New York troops coming en route to Baltimore. So they said, let's go back over to President Street Station, wait for the New York troops to arrive. We'll attack them next. When they got over, they found a trainload of Pennsylvanians waiting to cross the city next from Philadelphia. They attacked the train right at President Street Station, killing the first Pennsylvania soldier of the war. Now, one of the civilians that was doing this attacking was named Francis Xavier Ward. He was a colleague of James Ryder Randall at Georgetown, and James Ryder Randall was a school teacher that was teaching in New Orleans and read that his friend had been killed in this Civil War riot. And he wrote the poem My Maryland, which was set to music and became Maryland, My Maryland, the most famous battle hymn of the Confederacy after Dixie and the Bonnie Blue Flag.
That's wonderful. So you guys, give us some information on contact and what you're doing and stuff about your book and everything like that. Chris, first to you.
You and I, Dave, have talked about the rock opera, 1814. I recently arranged for the song sung by General Ross, Empire of Love, be sent by the composers Dave Israel and Dave Dudley to Northern Ireland, and it'll be played for a conference on General Ross and the War of 1812 in Ross Trevor, Northern Ireland. I'd like people to remember our upcoming 18th National War of 1812 Symposium to be held, hopefully, next year at Fort McHenry, hoping that there isn't a government shutdown. Should be the first Saturday in October 2014, and it will be a big one. People can reach me at editor1812@yahoo.com, and my journal website address. The journal used to be published as a print quarterly for a subscription price. It's now free and online, and we're going to have a new big one coming out with two articles on the USS Constitution by Tyrone Martin, who was the commander at the time of the U.S. Bicentennial and just spoke in our symposium last week. The website address is journal.thewarof1812.info.
Brilliant. How about you, Reverend?
Again, I'm at the Baltimore Civil War Museum. We're at 601 President Street here in Baltimore. Zip code is 21202. Our phone number is 443-220-0290. If you'd like to reach me, it's the Friends of PSS. That's President Street Station. Friends of PSS at AIMAppleIvanMary.com. Also, just wanted to mention, I've been running these temporary postal stations for the War of 1812 Bicentennial and the Sesquicentennial of the Civil War. So if anyone's interested in philatelic items, cachets with commemorative postmarks and stamps commemorating the War of 1812 Bicentennial and the Civil War Sesquicentennial, they're available at the museum. They're only available through us, not the post office. Contact us there and leave your name and number or your email. So basically, the museum is open every day except Tuesdays and Wednesdays. We're closed. We're open every day from 10 to 5. Come learn more about the Civil War.
Thank you. I want to thank Christopher George and Robert Reyes for being on Baltimore Internet Radio, and to be continued, because we're going to do a whole lot more of this. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.